Blog Talk Radio.
To keep Medicare and Social Security alive
as they are,
and been working on senior issues as well for many years, and hopefully he'll give us some information as to what
and give us the real information on Medicare and Social Security. I mean, you have many people saying it's bankrupt, it's not solvent, and all that stuff. A lot of that isn't true. It's just hype. Republicans can hardly wait to get their hands on it.
Yeah. So we're very interested to talk to him and see what's going on. And we got Pete Woody in the ring tonight, coming up around 9 o'clock. And between then and now, we got a whole bunch of incredible news and views for you. And let's see, I think we'll start off with how the rich executives spend millions. Is it interesting, though?
Uh-huh.
For bodyguards. To guard them from the populist anger. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Probably do that in Connecticut.
Another follow-up is that I wanted to read tonight is how the Americans don't even realize how badly we're getting screwed by the top 1% of hoarding the country's money.
Mm.
Well, so I think I'd like to go to that one first, and then we'll go to see how scared they are about it. That they're actually hiring bodyguards and everybody to keep them safe from regular people. They're afraid of us. Oh, here we go. Hang on a second. Okay. Americans don't realize just how badly we're getting screwed by the top 1% hoarding the country's wealth. With an unprecedented sum of wealth held within the top 1% of the U.S. population, we now have the most severe inequality of wealth in U.S. history. And what's more, when we asked them how they thought wealth should be distributed, they told us, and these are the people that they polled, they wanted an even more equitable distribution, with the richest 20% owing just 32% of the wealth. This was true of Democrats and Republicans, rich and poor. All groups we surveyed approved of some inequality, but their ideal was far more equal than the current level. The chart shows the survey, and it says it's amazing. The actual amount, top 20% own 80% of the 85% of the wealth. See?
Mm-hmm.
85% of the wealth in this chart. What people estimated was that they owed about 55 to 60%. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideal state for this would be that they only own about 30 to 32% of the actual wealth.
The overwhelming majority of the U.S. population is unaware of the vast wealth at hand. An entire generation of unprecedented wealth creation has been concealed from 99% of the population for over 35 years. Having never personally experienced this wealth, the average American cannot comprehend what is possible if even a fraction of that money was used for the betterment of society. Given modern technology and wealth, American citizens should not be living in poverty. The statistics demonstrate that we now live in a non-feudal society.
In a neo-feudal society.
In comparison to the wealthiest 0.1% of the population, who are sitting on top of tens of trillions of dollars in wealth, we are essentially propagandized peasants. The fact that the overwhelming majority of Americans are struggling to get by while tens of trillions of dollars are consolidated within a small fraction of the population, is a crime against humanity. The next time you are stressed out, struggling to make ends meet and pay off your debts, just think about the trillions of dollars sitting in the obscenely bloated pockets of the financial elite. I still cling to the hope that once enough people become aware of this fact, we can have the nonviolent revolution we so urgently need. Until then, the rich get richer as a critical mass with increasingly dire economic prospects desperately struggles to make ends meet. That was page two.
Oh, that was page two?
Yeah.
Oh, did we go to page one?
No, I think that was page one that we had from...
Hang on 1 second. Let's see if we can get to page one here. Anyway. Okay. Well, I guess that
first little piece maybe was page one.
It was page one.
So.
All right. So anyway, that's that.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much they really had.
Yeah, me either.
That's quite a shocking revelation to me. So now we'll have to figure out that's why they are hiring these bodyguards.
Yeah.
Let's read that that one. They have trillions of dollars that they're sitting on, so no wonder they need bodyguards. This is also from Alternate. Why don't you maximize that?
Second here. Right.
Rich executives spend millions for bodyguards to guard them from populist anger.
Meet World Protection Group, Inc.'s private bodyguards, the latest trend in corporate spending.
The primary, tall and flinty, with a graying goatee, has decided he's in the mood for shopping, a development that's got David Perez all worked up. I'm sitting with Perez in a Chevy Silverado in downtown Santa Monica. A FedEx Marine, Perez is in charge of the primary six-man protection detail. Six men! For 20 minutes, we've been waiting around in a grocery store parking lot, but now the primary has parked his Porsche 911 Carrera at a shopping strip nearly a mile away. Though Perez already has three counter-surveillance experts on the scene, he's antsy to join them. His client has a stalker, whom one of the team members had spotted earlier. The Silverado crawls through glacial traffic. You're driving like an old lady, Perez barks. Catch the green! Perez and his partner, Mike Gomez, a bodyguard resembling the soprano Silvio, finally track down their client at Barnes & Noble. Two of the counter-surveillance guys go back to scouting for menaces, while Perez and Gomez, both who are trained as sharpshooters and martial arts experts, step in as the primary's close protection team. Shoppers stare at the entourage, straining to recognize someone famous. The men form a barrier around the client as he stops to watch a street magic act, browse racks at Armani Exchange, wanders in and out of Hooters, and past a Gap. And that's when everything goes haywire. The stalker sprints around a corner, trailed by one of the counter-surveillance guys. He lunges at the entourage. Gomez wraps the primary in his beefy arms and yanks him away. The other agent intercepts the assailant mid-lunge and pins him against the wall with his elbows. He's out of place, says the primary. The agent and the stalker untangle their arms and laugh. The entire scenario was a training drill staged by the World Protection Group, Inc., an executive protection company with offices in Beverly Hills, New York, and Mexico City. The man playing the primary, not a real CEO, but a former Secret Service agent and narc, asked that I not use his name because he says he often works undercover in Mexico. Earlier that morning, he had lectured a group of trainees, WPG employees, and freelancers shelling out $575 for the session about the wide, wide world of corporate security. You are going to find yourself in places in 6 months or a year from now that you never thought you would get to, he said. On a screen behind him, a well-dressed couple strolled from a Learjet to a Jaguar, framed by a neon sunset. There are no reliable numbers on the growth of the executive protection, but the experts I spoke with say it has expanded at a rapid clip since the 1980s, with dozens of new players breaking into the game. That happens to be the same period which the top 1% of U.S. earners nearly tripled their annual income. More than a few of them, it seems, felt compelled to hire men with guns. I sat down with Ken Moyer, WPG's founder and CEO, in his cramped office. Moyer is trim, balding, and middle-aged. He got into private security back in the early 90s, serving a five-year stint as a bodyguard for Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion. I could write a book on just the things that I saw, he told me, but I get paid not to write that. But I got paid not to write that book. He was hired, he says, because he could knock heads. He'd place fourth in the International Okinawan Jiju Ryu Karate Federation Championship, and later trained with Steven Seagal in Aikido. For a while, he played B-movies. B-movie villains like a neo-Nazi in 1994's Femme Fatale, killer babe for the CIA.
But
let's see.
Moyer quickly learned that protecting Hef was less a matter of brawn than of discreet surveillance and detailed planning. By the early aughts, he'd launched WPG with a top Hollywood talent agency as his first client. The collapse of the World Trade Center towers proved a boon for executive protection soon after. WPG began landing corporate clients, and sales shot up 40% to 50%. Like most security professionals, Moyer won't name his clients. About 20% are celebrities and entertainers, he says, while the rest are wealthy individuals and corporate executives. The firm has protected senators, congressmen, former secretaries of state, and so on. As the as the business grew, Moyer took some time off and attended Worth's advanced management program. In 2009, the EP firm discovered a powerful marketing tool in the outrage over bank bailouts. There has never been this kind of populist anger before, said Eden Mendel, director of security consulting at Kroll, a risk advisory firm, told the Financial Times. When executives are revealed on television with bonuses, they become a target. Nearly 80% of executives polled by the American Society for Industrial Security agreed that the need for security has increased in the current economic climate, with general increases in crime and employee layoffs cited as the biggest threat. Executive protection firms like WPG and Steel Foundation reported revenue spikes of 30% to 50% in 2009, despite the recession. Now, business gets better as the economy gets worse, Moyer told me. The protection boom shows no sign of abating. Despite a weaker-than-expected feedstock of anarchy, violent crime in the United States is at its lowest in decades, and workplace violence, too, remains in a steady decline, says Eugene Ferraro, founder of a security consultancy called Business Controls, which manage workplace safety and hotlines for 23,000 clients. An executive who has ever really been confronted and their life threatened, that's kind of hard to find, he says.
So why have top execs and their boards become such security nuts? One factor involves the need to do business in the developing world. WPG claims it can provide services in 70 countries, but that doesn't explain that domestic demand. Ferraro chalks it up to paranoia. I get the calls, he says. They say, oh, my God, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal. The sky is falling. The tendency of business leaders to think over the horizon and anticipate problems and causing them to act like they're in Mexico City or Baghdad. Ferraro says, besides, why not play it safe when shareholders are picking up the tab? Since 2006, when publicly traded companies began disclosing corporate perks, spending on CEO security has increased, an average of 15% a year. Michael Dell's compensation package, for instance, includes $1.2 million for security.
That's Dell Computers.
That's ridiculous.
Another big part of EP's appeal might simply be executive convenience and protection. Firms claim that they can save executives an average of 90 minutes a day by conducting advances of venues. having cars and elevators waiting and thwarting unwanted advances from employees, media, whomever. The neat thing is that we've worked all this stuff out for you, Moyer says, and you don't have to worry about it. If the primary need is the Starbucks fix, he's likely to sit in the locked car checking email while his protector fetches a grand.
A grande,
right? And just a little more here. Moyer prides himself on allowing the hoi polloi to vent their frustrations after being refused an audience with a client. Even if you are not going to let them meet with your principal, I sit down and talk to them, he says, what sometimes all people need. But occasionally it can be hard to know whom to admit into a client's inner orbit. While on the job, not long ago, Gomez moved a stiff arm a thuggish-looking man. It was Jeff Zucker, president of NBC Universal. At WPG's training day, Gomez got a second chance to test his power of discernment. Back on Santa Monica crowded 3rd Street Promenade, the primary didn't seem to recognize a smiling man who approached, claiming to know him. Gomez raised his arms to keep the man away, but it was just a diversion. From another part of the crowd, two attackers hurled themselves at the primary. The agent sprang to meet them with palms jabbed and elbows thrust. Sunglasses were smashed, a cell phone was sent clattering, and bodies hit the pavement as shoppers got. Then the men got up and shook hands. The primary was untouched. And off to one side, a frail street person was taking it all in. Hey, guys, he beckoned to the pumped-up team members as they headed off to grab lunch. Can I get you to give me $1 to save a hungry people, to save the hungry people of Los Angeles? Interesting, huh? But, they're getting worried out there, and they get the money to do it, so they're... I think it's fascinating that they would be afraid of us, of everybody.
Well, they have a lot to feel guilty about.
Yeah, and they're afraid of everybody, you know. Like, who the hell knows these guys, you know? Some people stalk them, I guess. I don't know. But,
Well, I think it's guilt.
Yeah.
I think it's guilt.
It's guilt that creates it.
Yep.
This was an interesting one, too. Three ways racism still drives the Tea Party effort to destroy President Obama. Talks about how racism is, and they're talking quite a bit about it on the news lately, too, about how this Tea Party is so amazing.
Now, is that the first page?
Yeah, that's the first page. Three ways racism, I read that. To fail to understand this most basic of realities is to fail to understand American politics in the age of Obama. Mm-hmm. Want to read that? Or?
Yeah. I got to move over here. Somehow it's not centered. That's weird. Just as I did with their poor coverage of the Bertha issue, and out of fear of conservative backlash, the mainstream media is loath to speak truth to power and point out the obvious racial hostility is one of the primary forces driving the opposition of the Tea Party GOP to President Obama. This has been evident during the debt ceiling debate and on policy matters across the board. To fail to understand this most basic of realities is to fail to understand American politics in the age of Obama. Having matured with the smear campaign against President Bill Clinton, right-wing talk radio and Fox News have created an echo chamber in which ideological purity is the premier value. This dynamic has amplified the tensions between conservatives and the rest of the American people, and removed any possibility of finding a shared middle ground on the issue of common concern. A normal politics of negotiation and compromise is in peril because the terms of the debate are presented in dire, stark, and apocalyptic language. Sorry, folks. As a result, extreme party polarization, when added to a political conversation in which the volume has been turned up way high by the right-wing rage machine, has created a situation where the temptation to use racial appeals to destroy President Barack Obama is almost too great to resist. You want to read? Excuse me.
There are several elements driving the Tea Party's GOP efforts to blacken President Obama with the goal of limiting his ability to lead the country and hobbling the Democratic Party at every turn. The first element, why the surprise, The Tea Party is exactly who they have always shown themselves to be. The racial hostility of the Tea Party to the American African-American community and other people of color has well been documented. The race baiting of their leaders in public meetings, racist private emails that are later exposed and made public, and the stereotypical caricatures of President Obama as a pimp or the face of a faux food stamp featuring the White House and a patch of watermelons have been circulated by Tea Party organizations. Of course, the signs of their rallies and meetings that equate the president with an African witch doctor, Hitler, who is also not coincidentally a racial fascist, or that feature wicked slurs for black Americans, either written or as yelled at Representative John Lewis, are those common sense proof of how racial resentment and us versus them mentality gives meaning to the Tea Party movement. In fact, a prominent African-American Republican Party representative in California recently resigned because he could no longer be part of an organization that gave cover to such repeated acts of prejudice and bigotry.
Public opinion data has also demonstrated that the Tea Party supporters are more likely to believe that African-Americans are lazy, not hardworking, and that too much has been made of racism in American society. Providing important context, these attitudes are located within a broader political landscape and are likely shaped by a right-wing media where the idea that Barack Obama is anti-white, that white people are somehow oppressed or are victims in the 21st century America, is a recurring theme. Moreover, political scientists and sociologists have demonstrated that people who identify as conservatives are more likely to hold racially resentful and hostile attitudes toward non-whites. This is not a claim that all conservatives are racist, rather that negative racial attitudes can drive one's propensity to be conservative politically. Because the Tea Party is the Republican Party on steroids, these traits and impulses are amplified accordingly. The next page here. As Michael Lind has compellingly argued, the Tea Party movement is the latest echo of the Southern Confederacy. In all, they are neo-secessionists whose language of states' rights, nullification, and Second Amendment remedies harkens back to that old Confederacy. The federal government is viewed with deep hostility, and they are heirs to a political tradition that views the preservation of Jim Crow segregation in the name of states' rights as more important than the civil rights for black Americans. Tea Party representatives such as Rand Paul have echoed this suspicion of the civil rights laws which brought down Jim Crow. The Tea Party faithful have made repeated efforts to quite literally whitewash the U.S. history curricula of the Arizona and Texas school systems, and in their creative reimagining of the U.S. Constitution, the Tea Party GOP has conveniently removed all the bad parts, references to slavery, as a function of a feigned and convenient colorblindness that actively avoids the full complexity of the country's past and present.
In keeping with their oversimplification and flattering of history, even the Tea Party Revolutionary War era costumes and histrionic railings against the tyrannical government speak to an embrace of the lost cause ideology. Not coincidentally, the Confederacy also embraced the same symbolism and imagined themselves as the true heirs to the Founding Fathers, the real champions of the U.S. Constitution. And it's interesting that Perry is being so promoted for this, and he has been pushing cessation of Texas for since 2009.
They haven't mentioned it recently.
They did recently.
I just mentioned it tonight,
I heard. And the second element, the politics of white racial resentment are central to the Republican Party's electoral strategy.
Mm.
The Republican Party has skillfully used race as a political wedge issue for decades. The Nixon administration ushered in the Southern strategy with its twin tactics of leveraging white fears of black Americans and nurturing a white backlash against the civil rights movement. This strategy of mining social and cultural difference and ginning up white racial anxiety to advance political policy goals remains central to the Republican playbook in the 21st century. And as a counter to the Big Ten strategy of the Democratic Party, the Republicans were able to use state rights, a racist dog whistle famously used by Ronald Reagan in his notorious speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, as well as the culture wars narrative to flip the South to their party. The Southern Democrats, once a separate faction in the Democratic Party, are now an indispensable part of the Republican Party's electoral coalition.
Wow. The Tea Party is a natural outgrowth of the cultural war. The ethos of the Solid South and the Republican Party's full-on embrace of the politics of racial resentment. The election of the country's first black president gave freedom and voice to the worst anti-government and paranoid impulses of that coalition. Once fit only for late-night talk show radio and internet, in the age of Obama, the conspiracies and crazy talk that existed only on the fringes of American politics are now legitimated and given currency in the mainstream conservative thought. The Tea Party, GOP's embrace of the bizarre, its birtherism, or that the president is a closet Muslim Manchurian candidate socialist who hates America, is given purchase and traction by a deep racial paranoia toward the very personhood of Barack Obama. They see him as a de facto outside of the American experience. Thus, Barack Obama is not a real American. By implication, he is unfit to lead the country. Conservatives in America have also skillfully manipulated language in order to limit the ways that public policy is discussed. For example, once a proud and noble political label, liberal, has been transformed into a slur by conservatives. The language of race has been similarly reframed. Phrases such as reverse racism and playing the race card have been ushered by the right into our collective vocabulary. This language puts the onus on the victims of racism and removes the legitimacy of their justice claims. The conservative co-option of colorblindness has also created an environment where to even identify racist behavior and make a critical intervention against it is now framed as an act of racism.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing how they've done that.
We have to... I'm going to just read one more
That's
paragraph.
That's kind of a
here.
Long.
I posted this up on Facebook for those of you who may have seen this under Leo Steele under my Facebook name. And and these shifts in language paralleled the introduction of such ubiquitous phrases as "big government" by Ronald Reagan into the American political lexicon. The conservative mantras of limited or small government and a belief that the state is always the problem and never the solution has led to any number of deleterious public policy outcomes, most notably the Great Recession. The willingness of the right to assault public unions has also been tied to a sense that government sector disproportionately employs people of color. And consequently, they are also undeserving of wages and job security once enjoyed by workers in such positions. Public unions are therefore made easy targets for austerity initiatives and ruthless budget cutbacks. And furthermore, in the free market fundamentalist worldview of Tea Party GOP union are evil and the cause of the Great Recession as opposed to reckless tax policies in the new Gilded Age, where wealth and income are concentrated in the hands of the very few richest Americans at levels not seen since the 1920s. So I'm going to refer you to this article, and you can get it at alternet.org, okay, and check it out.
Three ways racism still drives the Tea Party's efforts to destroy President Obama.
And go to that. It's an excellent
article.
It's
a very, very good article.
Yeah.
Some things that I hadn't... It sort of sparked some things that I hadn't really thought about.
Yeah.
So
we're
going
to go to that.
Article.
And I'm going to go to check out Mr. I'm going to call.
Oh, are you going to call our guest?
Call our guest, right?
Oh, Leo's going to call our guest, who's
our
an
guest
expert
is Fred,
on
Fred Claridge. And see here. So I'm just going to call him now, and we will.
He's an expert on Social Security, Medicare.
Medicare, yeah.
He's with a particular
organization.
Hi, this is Fred.
Hi, Fred. This is Lila Wood
and Leo. And the LA Steel Show. How are you?
Fine. How are you guys?
Oh, we're just great. We're really anxious to talk to you because Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid has been in the news a lot. And
you think?
All over the TV and radio and all over talk shows. So could you tell us what organization you're with?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite understand. What was that word?
What was the organization that you are with right now?
Station?
Organization.
I'm so sorry. We just have a weird connection. I'm with an organization called Certified Senior Guidance Association. We are two things. We're a membership organization at no charge for seniors, and we're just an advocate for anything we believe is important for seniors. And we also are similar to a rating agency for similar to the Better Business Bureau, but for companies that want to deal with seniors.
Oh, okay.
So we're basically a senior advocacy group, an association.
And how long has your group been around?
We have basically, I'm trying to think, we probably go back about 4 or 5 years.
Okay. And how about you have members all across the country, I presume?
Again, they're not really members. They're just people that have signed up. We're, at this point here, we're nothing more than a sole proprietorship. We're not a nonprofit or anything of that nature. We're not a 501c4, which is a lobbying group similar to AARP. We're similar to the AARP's for-profit division.
We do that
so that we don't have to. You give up a lot of your identity when you become a nonprofit. You can't be political, and of course, this is very political.
I wanted to ask you because I took notice with I was quite offended by the AARP's.
Good for you. I am too. I think that I attacked the living hell out of them. I'm really very upset with them for two reasons, and the second one, if I can tell you about. Well, you go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Please do, because I was just furious with them over their lack of lobbying efforts there with this.
Well, there was no lobbying effort. The history on AARP, it goes back to the mid-50s, 1950s, and it was started by a woman. I can give you her name. I have it on my computer. She started basically with a wonderful intention of supporting teachers that were retiring. And in those days, teachers really did not make a lot of money. And boy, it was woeful when they went to retire. They had no money. But a month or two afterwards, a fella joined it. And I can provide you both names. Somebody had joined it. And it basically became an insurance sales company. In the 90s, it split into two companies. One, as I say, is a 501c4, which is similar to the 501c3, which is a nonprofit like Red Cross or your church or anything like that, except that 501c4 is permitted to do lobbying. The other part, they formed into a for-profit corporation. And the for-profit corporation now sells insurance. Their insurance for medical, which is what you see, what they call Medicare gap insurance, is United Healthcare. They sell auto insurance, which I believe is Liberty Mutual. They sell this insurance and that insurance. But the thing that really pissed me off the most, and I won't use that word on the air, was that during this last debate about the raising the ceiling, and I have this in front of me. They sent something out to everybody, and it was going to be returned to Barry Brand, who is the president. And what it is, it's really detestable. It said, it's a little sheet with a petition to your Senate leader, majority leader, senator for your state and to your representative. And it says, yes, we must do everything possible to stop legislation that will result in harmful cuts to Social Security and Medicare benefits. To aid AARP in its efforts to protect these important programs, I've signed my petitions. I am returning them along with a contribution in the amount of $10, $15, $25, $50, $100, or other. Now, this was being done, if you remember, everybody's angst during the during that debate. I don't know about you. I sat there every night. My stomach was turning. What the hell? What are they doing? S&P's going to downgrade us. Da da da. All these terrible things are going on, and these guys are asking for contributions.
Yeah.
I mean, this is hideous. But again, they can do under their nonprofit. So they've kind of slurped the two of them together. If you guys opened this company up, or I opened it up, we would have the IRS sniffing on us like a puppy dog in heat. I don't talk like that on TV, so or on radio, don't worry. But you know, people say try not to be political about this, but you cannot help but being political about a lot of what's going on.
Well, what do you actually think is the future for both Medicare and Social Security?
They're fine. We're going to be fine. This is the United States. We're going to figure this sucker out. I wrote a piece that you might look at on our website under current news or something like that, which basically gives my feeling on Social Security. What we know as a fact is that if nothing were to happen and nothing were to change in Social Security, it would be solid until 2037. At 2037, everything would have to be cut by about 30% down to 70% of what we're getting now. So that means that this is not something that has to be solved tomorrow. But like anything else, you know, running this country and running the Treasury, we see is like the old thing about the oil tanker. And an oil tanker can't just stop. You know, it takes like 20 miles for the darn thing to stop. And we have to start making plans today. Congress on both sides has been totally derelict in doing anything. This has been a problem that really hit the fan in about 1999. And everybody is aware of it. There are solutions. There are things that we can do. There are minor tweaks that can be done. I think two things that have been done, and that's politically. One is everyone's trying to scare the heck out of Granny by showing the pictures of her being pushed off the cliff, and both sides are doing it. I'm not going to pick out one. We're just seeing things that are intolerable as far as what political people are doing. The other thing is that we're totally disenfranchising the younger generation. Who's saying, well, I'm paying this is a tax, I'm never going to get money out. And I truly believe both are myths. They both will be around. Now, I'm 68 myself, and a lot of this I talk about on the show, so this might be redundant, but I'll talk about anything you want on the show. But basically, I laughed at Social Security, and I paid into it for whatever it was, the 40 years or so. You know something? I get $1,517. I know that to a penny. And I need it. It comes in the third Wednesday of the month, and I really look forward to getting that money. You know, and I thought, hell, this wouldn't mean a sack of beans to me, but I do what we do on through this certified senior. Even though we are technically a for-profit company, I don't charge anything for it. We're not making money. We're not doing this to make money. We're doing this really at this point to protect seniors, I think it keeps me sharp and it keeps my associates sharp. But basically, I need that money. Medicare, on the other hand, and Medicaid, that's a problem. And that's what I get into in the shows also, and that's what I wrote. You might want to, I can read it to you, you can read it yourself if you ever go on our site. I think things like a driver's license, voting, these are entitlements. When your husband or wife buys a life insurance policy, and God forbid they pass, so when you get paid, I don't consider that an entitlement, I consider that a contract. We haven't had a choice. I don't know about you, since I'm 68. I never had a choice. You had to do Social Security. And even when I had my own business, I always paid the 15% on myself. And we had to pay in Social Security. We had to pay into Medicare. And darn it, I want it now. I need it.
That's
and
right.
I've also had some Democrats, I've heard them say over the years, well, if Social Security is so bad, why don't you opt out? That's horse pee-pee. You can't opt out. There is no opt out. This is like the elections they used to have in Russia. You vote for Lenin or you go to jail. if you don't take Medicare, you're going to self-insure for cash.
Right.
So now you've heard me get on my pedestal, and I think there's a horrendous, horrendous shortage of leadership in this country, starting at the president, and I'm sorry to say, seems to be a great guy. I have tremendous admiration and respect, but you know, it's one of these things, he just doesn't get it. And Congress, I don't know if they get it either. There's such a gap right now, and I know all of this sounds hopeless, but again, this is the United States. We're gonna figure some way out of this. When you look at the Bill Gates and you look at the Googles and you look at a lot of these other people and what we can do with cell phones today. I mean, I can't even figure out a cell phone today. how can you hold a thing in any direction and the screen comes out normal? I mean, come on, this is a non-problem.
Not only that, but they found that cell phones cause cancer. Okay, brain cancer. Okay, and they've been proven in a number of studies that over 10 years will cause severe damage to your brain, right? Because you're putting that radioactive device right next to your ear.
The good thing is, if nothing else, I know, like I'm in Nevada, but in California they've passed laws, and they do in most states, that you must use a Bluetooth. So the only time I really use my cell phone is when I'm in the car, and of course at that point it's like being on a speakerphone. So it never really goes against my ear. But you're right. Maybe it'll force people to keep the thing away from their ears. The bad thing is it's causing all these kids to text, and it's okay when the kids do it. It's when the train engineer does it or the pilot does it. That's when it gets a little dicey.
Medicare and retirement. Do you think that people should be putting their money other places? That Medicare definitely, and Social Security are not enough.
They never have been enough. Both of them, I believe. Now again, I don't go back that far. Both of them were really set up as safety nets. With Social Security, there is something, and most people say if you can, you should set a goal to set aside about 16% of your net earnings and put it put it someplace to save. The other strong suggestion is don't listen to Cramer. The only time an investment gets exciting is when it goes wrong. That's an investment that you put into conservative blue chip stocks with a 2 or 3% yield. You go into very, very safe investments. If you can, and you really, and you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s, and you believe Social Security isn't going to be there, then start putting some money together yourself. Most of us do become very unprepared for retirement. Try to do something yourself. I can't live on $1,500 a month. I mean, come on, today you got my darn TV, my dish TV is $100 a month. Give me a break. That's before I get up in the morning. Yeah, I'm also a very big proponent on something now that people say, but for young people, I think you got to buy a house. I don't care what the price goes, because I look at myself, I live rent-free. So yeah, my house at one time, I bought it for $150 or $160. At one time, it was worth $320. That didn't mean garbage to me. Now it's worth $120 or $130. That doesn't mean garbage. What does matter to me is I don't write a check every month. That does mean something to me. So I believe every American that can afford it should buy a house. There shouldn't be any type of, and again, this is all my personal opinion, there shouldn't be any type of speculation. Freddie and Fannie should have been doing what FHA did, and FHA had a policy that they would only finance for an owner-occupant. But Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae allowed you to own 8 properties. That's ridiculous. You know, but that's a different story. But both of these are going to be here. I like to start in the shows by saying, you know, just don't lose sleep tonight. Don't get scared. Number two is you have to consider the source. Even me, what is the political perspective of the person that's talking to you? Because they're, in more cases than not, if your stomach is getting queasy, they have some political. There's something political that they're trying to tell you. And you know, even with the social, with Medicare, and I do rip the president and the Democrats on it's called the Affordable Health Care Act, which is Obamacare, and that is one thing I play like a hick, and I tell people, and I'll tell you on your show if you want. I went to San Jose State College and I graduated in 1964. It wasn't a university, it was a state college. And my dream in life, and I'm serious, was to be in the top half of the bottom half of the class. And darn it, I was successful. So I'm no brain. I'm probably as average as anybody out there, except that I'm heavier. But, you know, I don't understand the new math that comes out of Harvard. You know, Larry Summers in Harvard and Tim Geithner and Ms. Romer, who's over at Berkeley. I don't understand how, you know, let's say that you and I were going to get married, and you owe $500 on your Visa card, and I owe $500 on my Visa card, and we get married, and all of a sudden, because we're married now, we only owe $350 on the credit card. Now, Harvard has a way of calculating that we at San Jose State never learned. We're so dumb, we think we now owe $1,000. So I'm not privy to the new math.
You know what you're saying is, but I could never understand what this bailout represented until I realized that the $14 trillion, actually, it was $16 trillion, all right, was actually lent to foreign banks, all right? It was actually, that was what this bailout was, and that's why we are $14 trillion in debt right now.
Well, right? The bailout program was, and again, this is my own personal opinion, it was a good idea at the time. The problem is that it became politicized. So instead of going to projects where we would get, you know, we know there's going to get some is good. This is good old America. Some's going to get skimmed off the top. But by the time we got done, you heard the stories like if you remember years ago about the $2,000 toilet seat that the same toilet seat you could buy at Home Depot for $395, NASA was buying for $40,000, and it was the same thing. So out of the $1 trillion that was spent, maybe $300 million or $300 billion actually got there, and the other $700 disappeared. You know, kind of like the Iraq oil deal. And that was the problem. So I think that we needed to spend the money, and it would have been good, but it never got to where it should have gotten, and like everything else, it was wasted. And that's why we had stories about, you know, a company. There was one that just went bankrupt today. I watch CNBC because I play around with stocks. And it was a company today that used to trade at about $120 a share. They went bankrupt today at $68 a share, and they were in one of the new green ideas. And I think it was a solar panel company. And I can look up the name because I don't like to give something that sounds like a rumor. It's an actual company. And the problem is that when they put this company together, and the government funded most of it, so the government actually was one of the biggest losers aside from individuals. The problem is that the same product was coming in from China, and we never did anything to protect and let this company be competitive. And, of course, the Chinese and the other companies are heavily government supported, and we couldn't compete, and the company went bankrupt today. It starts with an E. I mean, it was like Ecolab or something like that. It's a real story and a real company, and it happened today.
Yeah, well, what I was talking about was the bailout. What he was mentioning was the bailout, and what we did is we bailed out a lot of foreign banks, and that's what had...
No, the money ended up going to the banks because the banks were part of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So since they had established branches here and they were guaranteeing monies, it put us in a position where we were forced to. And you're absolutely right. And many of those banks are going under now with the European problems. But you are right. It went to a lot of places. It went to a lot of things that it shouldn't have gone to, because bailing out a bank did not add one job.
Yeah, but Fred, can I explain this, please?
All please right. Do. Please do.
It wasn't the FDIC that they bailed out. What it was the Federal Reserve Banks that they bailed out. Now, Bank of Scotland, Royal Bank of Scotland, Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, Bank of America, all right? These, there are actually eight major banks that are Federal Reserve Banks. And what happened was that the Federal Reserve printed, gave them all of this money just to bail them out, okay, because they were so heavily involved with the mortgage-backed derivatives and securities, all right, that they were going under like nobody's business, all right, and so all of these monies went to these foreign banks, all right, and it was actually quoted at over 16 trillion now, dollars, okay? Financial Times quoted it, okay? Several of the major mainstream media quoted it.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Bernanke, when he was interrogated, questioned by the Congress, all right, they said, where did this money go? Where did the money go? And Bernanke says, I can't tell you. And they said, well, why can't you tell us? He says, because if I told you, it would cause complete global economic collapse. All right?
If I tell you, I got to shoot you, right?
That's exactly what he said. And I saw the interview. I saw when it happened. But the problem was that even the Congress wasn't aware of how much money it was until much later.
And he just
gave everybody, all of these foreign banks, okay, money, all right, big time money, trillions of dollars on the taxpayers' dollars, okay? And what happened was all of a sudden they're saying, well, gee whiz, Bush only had an $800 billion deficit when he left office. Yeah, but everybody forgets that he left office with the bailout, all right? And that bailout went, and then all of a sudden it became Obama's bailout, okay?
The first bailout was Bush and Paulson, and the only thing they did wrong there was a problem that Geithner created, and that was they really should have bailed out. They should have held up Lehman Brothers, because when they didn't let it up, that's when we ended up owning GM and AIG. But in these things here, I have nothing. You know, when you look at the original thing with Lee Iacocca, and the government lent money to Chrysler, and Chrysler paid it back with profits, and now the government is slowly getting paid back on some of these ventures, and they did protect jobs. And again, you know, I'm conservative, so don't misunderstand me. The bailout that really was the one that was over the hump was the Obama bailout after the original bailout, and that was the money that was supposed to go to shovel-ready jobs, and it didn't. That's the one where a lot of money disappeared. On the other, I yield to you. I really don't, I don't know about money going to foreign banks, and I'm sure it's true, because everything else that sounds too outrageous to be true is.
But that's why there was $14 trillion. That's why they're talking about this incredible deficit all of a sudden. All right? It all of a sudden came out of nowhere, right? In 2 years, it mushroomed into insane amounts of money. All right? And the reason for that is because the Federal Reserve issued that money without Congress approval, even without presidential approval, nobody's approval other than Ben Bernanke. He gave them all this money, which is taxpayer dollars. This is, every dollar is owed by the American taxpayer to the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These guys created trillions and trillions of dollars, gave them to the foreign banks to bail them out. And guess what? Guess who created this nightmare of a mortgage collapse, of an economic collapse? None other than the great Hank Paulson himself. He was the genius at Goldman Sachs who created the mortgage-backed securities and the derivatives, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was Hank Paulson, when he left Goldman Sachs, he made over $300 million in profits, okay, for personal profits for himself. Goldman Sachs, all right, was the culprit behind this entire nightmare. Senator Levin, all right, came out and stated this in after a 2-year investigation, all right, and the Senate Investigation Committee. Levin stood there for over an hour, reading the indictments against Goldman Sachs that they had found, and Goldman Sachs is now being indicted for massive fraud, all right, which caused this nightmare of a collapse. They were betting
we'll see what happens.
Betting billions of dollars against their own clients, for crying out loud. All right? Betting against their clients. All right? And that that these mortgage-backed securities would fall. And what they did is they took the AIG, they grabbed AIG's you know, AIG was a sucker, all right? And AIG, they bought the insurance to back their investments. And then when they knew everything was going to go bad, and once everything went bad, what happened? AIG went south as well, and the government backed AIG and picked up the tab, okay, for all of this. So this was all part of the bailout as well. So these trillions, and I say, Fred, trillions of dollars were blown, okay, because of Hank Paulson, George Bush, Barack Obama, okay, Geithner, Sumner, okay, Summers, and all of these clowns, okay. And who was Geithner? Geithner was none other than the governor for the Federal Reserve, governor of New York.
Okay? That's right.
And who was Sumner? Was some was nothing but a very bad president of Harvard. Okay, with a financial backing, and he was probably, I don't know if he was also involved with Goldman Sachs as well.
No.
But it seems like to me the only money that's left is they want to get a hold of it, and that's Social Security.
They've been looking at this thing. They've been salivating over Social Security forever,
They want to privatize it so that they can steal it.
Yeah.
And has your organization that you're representing, this group, do you actually go in and try to talk to representatives or people in Congress?
No. We don't. We stay away from that. We're not lobbyists. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the worst parts of our government. I think they should do away with lobbyists. That they're nothing more than payoffs.
Okay.
I don't believe that anybody should have special access to a congressman or the president, either from a $47,000 a plate dinner or because they hire a lobbyist to speak on their behalf. I have tried to contact Barney Frank's office. I've tried to contact Representative Ryan's office. I've tried to contact Shelley Berkeley, who is our representative, my representative, whose office is maybe five blocks from where I live. I can't get through to anybody there, and that's because I'm not a lobbyist. The only way you can get through is either give them a lot of money or have a large enough organization that you can threaten them with a boycott. They're the same as a scamster. A scamster goes for two emotions. They either try to hit you on greed or fear. And those are the only two emotions that work against the congressperson, is greed, where you're going to give them money, or fear, where you're going to do something that's going to keep them, that might hurt them from getting elected. So, we agree in a lot of cases. I disagree a little bit with you. I won't argue with you on any of the points, but... I think what happened with the economy and where it started to go bad had a lot to do with the housing bubble, and that goes back to the late 80s and early 90s, and it goes back to, as I say, something. And I went on record with you, and I said I do believe everybody that could afford a home should own one. I said that to you earlier, but they started to put people in homes that could not afford it, and there was a new class of loan that was created. Which was called the subprime loan, and that goes back to the mid 80s and early 90s. That basically was set up to really screw the minorities who didn't understand too much. You could get them in one of these HUD rehab homes. You buy the flipper would buy it for $500, turn around and sell it for $15,000, and then someone would get them a loan on $30,000. And that had a lot to do with Christopher Dodd and with Barney Frank, and then they would control. They controlled two organizations, which was Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They were at one time 100% government corporations. The government decided to relinquish. They did the worst part. They kept the liability, but they gave away the asset, and they became public companies. And these companies were so derelict, but they could not fund subprime. So all of these people went to Wall Street. And they went to the different Wall Street companies and packaged exactly what you had. Then S&P and Fitch and Moody's came along and rated these A. Now, to think for 1 minute that the people that bought these did not know what they were buying is ridiculous. They had their own Harvard-educated analysts. They knew what they were buying. The problem was is that these packages included mortgages that were based on very inflated prices and prices that could not be substantiated. We've had housing bubbles in the past. We had a housing bubble, at least in California. We had a very serious one in the early 90s around the time of the earthquake. So the original problem was the number of loans that were made that were not substantiated by appraisals. There used to be a joke that the top appraisal is called an MAI appraisal, and that is the highest lettering that you can get as an appraiser. But the joke became MAI meant made as instructed. You know, it wasn't real. So they created a product, which was a subprime loan, and they said, now how are we going to get this funded? And they said, aha, Wall Street, they'll sell it. You know, give it to Mikey, he'll eat anything. Wall Street will sell anything. If they can make a buck, they'll sell anything. And they all sold them.
Hank Paulson, that was Hank Paulson and Goldman Sachs. Hank Paulson was the guy who created the mortgage-backed derivatives, okay?
No, I won't argue, but this happened before Paulson became in power. They didn't create that. That was created by smaller companies that were packaging these. And this was the. But what you're talking about is where they were selling things on which they had taken short positions. And to an extent, legally it wasn't wrong at the time, but morally it really didn't pass the smell test.
No, that's for sure.
Do you know, I just read today that 92% of all the foreclosures in New York State right now are illegal foreclosures because none of the documentation is correct, none of the legal documentations. These banks do not really own those properties, all right?
Well, yes, they do. They're foreclosed. Now, look, I'm a conservative. These are all technicalities. You go back to the beginning. This is like, in my opinion, and again, I don't want to argue with you because you're my host. But basically, in that situation, that's the old joke about the kid who kills his parents and then throws himself in the mercy of the court because he or she's an orphan now. These people borrowed money. At some point, someone has to take responsibility. They borrowed money and they made a determination to buy a house. They did not make the payments. Okay, they haven't made payments for 6 months or a year. Now, to say that the way it's being foreclosed is illegal, that's very popular. And, of course, you got 50 attorneys, which are the state attorney generals, that are now saying, well, they signed the document wrong. Signing the document wrong had nothing to do with these people stopping making payments a year or two before this. And so to say, and look, and I'm not defending the banks. They suck. I try not to deal with banks. I don't like banks. I don't like the mentality. Let me tell you a story. I used to be a banker. For 20 years I was in banking, and people would come, this is a joke, but people would come to me for a loan, and I'd say, you know what, I have a glass eye. And you look in my eyes, and if you could tell me which one's the glass eye, you get the loan. And they would look, and then they'd say, it's the right eye. I'd say, you're right, how did you know? They said, that's the one with the warmth. That's a joke, but you know, so I have no love for banks, but you have to understand that somebody who has not lived up to an obligation to make a payment for 1 year or 2 years, I don't care if they lost their job, I don't care what the reason is, they're wrong. Now, to say that the bank signed the foreclosure, when they went to do the foreclosure, that it was robo-signed, I mean, that's 60 Minutes garbage. Yeah, they're foreclosing it in a way that is illegal, but that's really, that's fishing, and they're making the banks pay, and the more, and you understand, the more the banks pay, you know, who's going to pay the final bill?
Well, I think there was a lot of wrong on both sides, and you know what? We're right at the top of the hour, and we have another guest coming on, but we really enjoyed hearing your...
Was this the show?
What's that?
Was this the show that we did?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize. I wouldn't have talked that way if this was a show. I'm sorry.
That's quite fine. That's
no, you're
fine.
On, you're on, you're on.
Oh, I wouldn't have used that language. I apologize to you.
Oh, sorry. No, it's okay. We say worse than that. So,
oh no, but I would never go against your thought. You know, you guys are brilliant and you really know your stuff. I was just trying to be a devil's advocate. I think we have the same thoughts, right? I really do.
I'd love to talk to you more, Fred. But we got another guest on the line.
Go for it. Thank you so much, and I hope I didn't say anything offensive because I think the world of you guys. I'm with you virtually 100%.
Well,
points of view, and we appreciate yours, too.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
And now we have some music for In the Ring with Woody. He'll be right along.
Thank you, Lila. Stellar introduction. In contrast to your last guest, I like to be as offensive as possible, especially to my hosts. So just make note of that.
Okay.
Thank you. By the way, Lila, I heard you had quite a shindig at your place on Saturday. Any truth to that, or is that an internet rumor?
Oh, no, that's the truth. It was quite an event.
Huh. I guess I'll look for my invitation next year. Okay. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, jury out on Bradley, Tiger DeClaude, football news, and, of course, baseball. All right, let's get down to it. I'm going to lead off with a little bit of golf. Keegan Bradley said he never lost hope, but as we watch, we might have. Bradley came back from five strokes behind to win the PGA Championship on Sunday. That was definitely one for the history books. The same PGA Championship that Tiger Woods failed to qualify for. More on that in a minute. Bradley became the third player after Francis Ouimet and Ben Curtis to win his first major outing. "It's been the best golf I've ever played," Bradley said, in what might be the greatest understatement of the golf season. Now, the question is not how good Bradley was Sunday. Nobody would argue that point, but the question is, you know, where can he go from here? The golf world thus far is littered with one-time wonders and also would-bes and examples of launching pads for greatness, the 1997 Masters for Tiger Woods kind of being the most memorable of the latter. Since Bradley was the 13th winner in at least 13 majors, it would not be a stretch to predict that he will fade. But anyone who saw his mental toughness and his physical ability could make an argument for future greatness. Now, back to Tiger. Tiger Woods' disastrous showing in the PGA Championship has some doubting in his golf future. Greg Norman is not one of them, though, apparently. The two-time major winner, Norman told the Sunday Mirror that Woods would win again, and the superstar golfer just had to overcome a mental hurdle. "You have to wake up every morning, look yourself in the mirror, and the question you ask yourself, you must answer truthfully," Norman said. "Happiness comes from within. It doesn't come from anywhere else. He will work it out." However, then Norman goes on to say that Woods will never again be an intimidating factor. "Now he's trying to beat them instead of them trying to beat him," Norman said. "The guys coming up haven't seen Tiger's dominance. The role reversal is the big difference." Now, to me, that doesn't sound really much like a Tiger backer, but, you know, I totally agree with what he said. The role reversal is the big difference. And, you know, Tiger now has to beat the field instead of the field trying to beat Tiger. It's a totally different ball game, you know, mentally. And the question remains, you know, is Tiger going to be mentally tough enough to be able to, you know, go out and handle his business and beat the field? Whereas before, it seemed like the pressure was on the field just to beat Tiger. So now a big role reversal, much like Norman says, and it'll be worth watching. I frankly think and hope that Tiger is just going to fade, and he's never going to be dominant again. I think he may win one or two more majors. You know, every dog has his day. But I just don't think he's ever going to be a monster factor again, and he's certainly not going to reach Jack Nicklaus's status. Moving on to a little bit of football news. Now, it's been a long off season and some crazy stuff with the lockout and everything else, but after all that, we're going to talk about the New York Jets, 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 Jets. Now, as I said, it's been a long time. We talked about a little bit of football, and, you know, Rex Ryan's had quite a break And throughout that time, he's given his mouth quite a rest, and now he's revved it up for this season. And he comes right out of the box with a totally crazy statement. He was speaking to ESPN before last night's game against the Texans, and he says he expects wide receiver Derek Mason to make 90 to 100 catches. Now, last year, he made 61 catches with the Ravens. Now, this is what Ryan said. Adding Derek Mason is huge, he told the network. I don't know if people realize how big this is. Now, this seems kind of delusional, you know, prediction, considering Mason is like 37. The team is a run-first offense, and the Jets already have Santonio Holmes and Plaxico Burress as their top two receivers. This is just more of the same from Rex Ryan. He's like that positive talking kind of guy, and, you know, he takes it over to the top, and as you can see, he's already ready to get things going. He's already making one crazy, crazy statement as it is. So good for Rex. He's always good print and always easy to talk about. If I had a chance for, you know, to pick a coach, to be my coach, I think I would pick him. He's a positive guy, and he's always behind his guys, and you got to love that. Anyway, moving on. Okay, there's a little Twitter feud brewing. A couple of months ago, Eagles running back LeSean McCoy and the New York Giants is causing some current awkwardness now in the Philadelphia locker room. As some of you may or may not know, Steve Smith, former Giant receiver, bolted and signed with the Philadelphia Eagles last week. Now, when he first got there, he received and he continues to receive a flossy reception from McCoy for joining in OCU Nomura and Justin Tuck in the nasty social media firefight between NFC East rivals. McCoy started the whole thing in June when he wrote on Twitter that, you know, Moore is soft, overrated, and no better than the Giants' third-best defensive lineman. I remember when he came out with that. That was pretty brutal. And then, you know, Moore responded by referring to McCoy as a she, which is great. That's just beautiful. And comparing him to garish pop singer Lady Gaga. Also hilarious. Calling him a girl and basically a queer, which for black dudes is like over the top. Tuck also blasted McCoy publicly, and then Smith joined into the fray by tweeting a picture of the Eagles' empty trophy case superimposed over the Giants' 2008 Super Bowl celebration. Smith also blasted McCoy on Twitter for having the nerve of certain youngins running their mouths. Smith sought out McCoy in the locker room last week in the hopes to kind of, you know, put the whole matter at rest, you know, trying to be a gentleman about it. But McCoy was having none of it, and he kind of scowled at the mere mention of Smith's name, and he made it clear hard feelings still remain. They told Smith he was still upset. When Smith tried to clear the air, McCoy said, "Yeah, something like that." That's great. When you get right down to it, guys are bitches. That is so funny. Dude is mad over something he said on Twitter. Are you serious? Are you like 12? Maybe you really are a girl. God, that is funny, dude. That is seriously hilarious. Mad over something somebody said on Twitter. Get over it, dude. You're all getting paid big money to play a boy's game. Get over it, you punk. Unbelievable. All right. Moving forward, a little bit of baseball news. Some interesting stuff goes down. This doesn't happen every day. Jim Thome hit his 600th career home run and received his due recognition from, you know, the ones that really matter to him, the fans. The Minnesota Twins designated hitter became the eighth player to reach the milestone when he slammed two homers Monday in a 9-6 win versus the Detroit Tigers at Comerica Park. Thome's pursuit of the 600 plateau has drawn relatively little attention from the national news media, but Tiger fans awarded the veteran slugger with a standing ovation. Pretty classy. Thome turns 41 on August 27th, connected for home runs 599 and 600 on back-to-back swings. He hit a two-run shot to left center off Rick Porcello in the sixth, and then took lefty Daniel Schlereth out to right field in the seventh with two on. Thome will finish with five RBIs, was met by his father, wife, and children after arriving at home plate for a brief celebration. The New York Yankees' A-Rod became the youngest player to hit his 600 home run last August, barely a week past his 35th birthday. But Thome holds an impressive distinction of his own. The soft-spoken Thome, a popular figure at all his major league stops, got 600 home runs in 8,137 at-bats, fewer than any hitter other than Babe Ruth, 6,921. Pretty good numbers, though, man. Moreover, Thome has not been linked to steroid use, but if you look at him at times, you kind of think he might have, you know, taken the needle. Rodriguez acknowledged using performance-enhancing substances during a three-year period. when he played for the Rangers, and God knows how long he did it in other places. Once these guys get bagged, of course, you know, they were only using at the time that they got bagged. They weren't using, you know, before that and got away with it or just whatever. And, you know, you never know what to believe when these dudes get pinched for using steroids, you know. They say they did it for 3 years, but, you know, could have been 10 years. You don't know. And if you ask me, that whole era of dudes, it's just tainted. But two others in the 600 home all-time home run club leader, Barry Bonds, 762, and Sammy Sosa, also seen their accomplishments tainted by strong steroid suspicions. The inflative offensive numbers during a so-called steroid era might help explain the relative lack of hype as Tommy approached the milestone. People are just kind of sick of it, and they're kind of over the whole 600 thing. Plus, Tommy doesn't really play in a big market. I think if he was in Philly, it would be like a little bit bigger because Philly is almost like an American League team, like a big market and stuff, whereas Minnesota is just so not. Tommy has led the league in homers once. He hit 47 for the Phillies, the aforementioned Phillies, in 2003. But he's a good guy. He seems to be a classy guy. Again, you know, he's probably did juice in the past, but, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Pitchers are doing it. Hitters are doing it. You don't see any of the players say anything bad about dudes that have been pinched with the steroids. Guys still act like Barry Bonds walks on water when they see him. No one says anything shitty about him. What does that tell you? That tells you that, you know, most of the other players were also juicing, and, you know, they just know. It's all good as far as they're concerned. I mean, you know, they're the ones that are playing the game. They know. I mean, if they had issue with him juicing, believe me, the indication would be that only a few players juiced, but no one has any problems. What does that tell you? Come on, everybody was juicing. Dudes are as big as football players playing baseball, and it's never been like that. Never. So, anyway, that's my rant, I guess. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Linda and Sherry up in Maine, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Try and enjoy summer because, man, it's slipping away.
Okay. Thank you, Woody. Our guest, Fred, who did a good job, and who is interested in keeping Social Security and Medicare around for all of the seniors.
And everybody who...
And if you're lucky enough, you'll become a senior. The alternative isn't so good.
Yeah.
So you too will want Medicare and Social Security.
The alternative isn't so good, no.
You're not around to collect it.
But anyway, we want to, We're gonna go for a quick music break there, and then get our senses back, and come back to we got a whole lot of news to bring to you tonight, some health issues, as well as other things, and we'll be right back. And
how about October night for your listening enjoyment? No, too long.
How about your favorite? Play your favorite.
This one.
All You Can Eat.
All You Can Eat. We can play that.
Like
that's a good one. Yep.
And we had a party this weekend with All You Could Eat, All You Could Drink. And it's Lila's birthday party.
That's not it. That's All Is Not Lost.
Oh, that's true. Right here.
That's it. Right there.
Okay, so...
All You Can Eat for your listening enjoyment.
And we'll be right back after this song.
right. That was all you can eat.
And we are going to give you some more news. This was this came up, and I, you know, everybody, I don't want to talk too much more about this man because I really dislike him. But we have a little video on him as well tonight, and on Perry. And it says 21 reasons Perry's Texas is a complete disaster.
And what people don't know is that, and don't realize is that the governor of Texas, that office is just ceremonial. They don't make any policy at all.
No, the lieutenant governor is actually the one who does most of the heavy lifting.
Yeah, they don't do anything except smile and cut ribbons.
Yeah, I mean, Bush was a complete joke in that office, as well as so was as this guy. But there's a lot to this man that isn't known, and a lot about Texas that most people don't understand. And I think it's important to read this. excuse me a second here. Just let my computer come together. 21 reasons Rick Perry's Texas is a complete disaster. Third world status, the real promise of a Rick Perry administration, shouldn't be a goal to which the United States aspires. And,
Rick Perry's road to the White House will be paved with spin and blatant lies of omission. He's basing his entire campaign on a single data point. Texas, with 10% of the country's population, has produced 37% of the net new jobs in the U.S. since the recovery. That kernel of truth, as I noted recently, is mostly a result of a massive increase in the state's population. Much of it is due to Hispanic immigration. Texas's unemployment rate has actually risen, even as those jobs are being created. Texas also leads the nation in creating crappy minimum wage jobs without benefits. The number of minimum wage workers increased by 150% between 2007 and 2010. He also lucked into a boom in energy prices in his oil and gas-rich state, another factor having nothing to do with his governance. Under Perry, endless tax breaks for politically connected Texas corporations helped create a massive budget deficit that Perry first addressed with federal stimulus funds, money from a program he decried as a misguided desire to spend our children's inheritance, and then by cutting spending on education in the state's already threadbare social services to the bone. With the exception of a few economic basket cases like Mississippi, Texas is way ahead of the pack in the race to the bottom. Rick Perry's line on this obviously is quite different. In announcing his candidacy last weekend, the governor bragged that we have led Texas based on some just really pretty simple guiding principles. One is don't spend all the money. Two is keeping the taxes low under control. Three is if you have your regulatory climate fair and predictable. Four is reform the legal system so frivolous lawsuits don't paralyze employers that are trying to create jobs. Over the years, we have followed this recipe to produce the strongest economy in the nation. This talking point is being echoed across the conservative message machine. The Wall Street Journal editorialized that the core impulse of Obamanomics is to make America less like Texas and more like California, with more government, more unions, and more central planning and higher taxes. In May, Newt Gingrich told Fox host Sean Hannity, I know how to get the whole country to resemble Texas. It's a terrifying thought, looking at the number of jobs the state has added in isolation and deeply misleading. We don't only face a job crisis in this nation, we face a crisis of rising economic insecurity. The American middle class is embattled in keeping up with population growth by adding jobs, serving up fast food, and greeting Walmart shoppers doesn't help ameliorate the kind of economic pain millions of Americans are suffering. So to add some perspective, let's take a broader look at how Texans are faring under Rick Perry's watch. Several of the following items were compiled by Peter Montgomery at Right Wing Watch. Number one, Texas leads the nation in the percentage of its population without health insurance.
Only one state covered a smaller share of its poor population with Medicaid.
Number three, it's also number one in the percentage of children who lack insurance.
Texas ranks dead last in the number of women who receive early prenatal care.
Number five, it has the sixth highest rate of infectious disease in America.
Number six, it ranked 35th in the share of its children being immunized.
Number seven, and 40th in overall health.
Number eight, those numbers shouldn't come as a surprise. Texas had the ninth lowest level of health care spending per person. And these are all based on 2010 figures.
Number nine, Texas ranked 36th in the nation in terms of its high school graduation rate.
Number 10, it has the lowest share of population aged 25 and older holding a high school diploma of any state. So, my God. So, yeah. And it goes on. We're going to continue here in just a second. 11, its students have the sixth lowest SAT scores in the country.
Number 12, but Texas ranked fourth in terms of teen pregnancies.
13, it got the 16th highest crime rate.
Number 14, it ranks 17th in the occupational fatalities.
Number 15, it tied with Missouri for 19th in terms of the share of its citizens requiring food stamps.
Number 16, it leads the nation in the amount of recognized carcinogens released into the air.
17, has the fourth highest amount of toxic chemicals in the environment.
Number 18, Texas's per capita income growth was the eighth slowest of any state in the country between 1998 and 2008.
Number 19, it ranks 47th median household net worth average from 2007 to 2009. 47th median household.
Number 20, only seven states have a higher percentage of children in poverty.
And 21, only nine states have a higher percentage of people of all ages living below the poverty line.
This is what conservative governance leads to: slow growth, poor social outcomes, greater inequality, and fewer protections for workers and the environment. And that is indeed what the right would like to see imposed on the nation as a whole. In March, Republican staffers on Congress's Joint Economics Committee released a study responding to criticism that the deep public sector cuts they advocated would derail an already anemic recovery. The paper called for decreasing the number and compensation of government workers, which the staffers said would spur job creation because a smaller government workforce increases the available supply of educated skilled workers for private firms, thus lowering labor costs. There are no jobs.
No. So a central plank in the GOP's economic recovery plan is to flood the market with yet more unemployed people in order to drive wages, which have stagnated for an extended period, further down. In theory, an unhealthy, poorly educated population earning poverty wages in a country with low taxes, minimal environmental regulation, and crappy public services would indeed lead multinationals to create more jobs here at home. But third world status, the real promise of a Rick Perry administration, shouldn't be the goal to which the United States aspires. And
that was written by Joshua Holland, and it's a writer at Alternet.
15 biggest lies about the economy, and it's alternet.org, I believe. So you can check that out. It's actually pretty staggering, you know. And I wanted to there's one more. We're going to Rick Perry you to death here, but
the media is just loving him up.
Yeah, and meet the Christian Dominionist prayer warriors who have chosen Rick Perry as their vehicle to power. This is another sick article, and I have to read it. I just feel you'll never be able to read it unless you go to alternate.net. You'll probably check it out, but some of these go back a couple of days, so. Go into their archives, but hang on one second, and I will read this. Okay. The new apostolic. Thank you. Reformation seeks dominion over society and government, and it looks like Perry is their chosen candidate.
There's a previous page. Let's see. If you go to the bottom, you can get it all on one page.
Sorry, folks. Leo. One more time. Hold on, folks. I'm trying to bring it up here.
Now, if you go to the bottom of that page, when it comes up, it says it'll put it all on one page.
I'm going to try one more time, though, if you don't mind.
Not now. Let's go to another article and then come back to that.
All right. I don't know if anybody saw this or not, but this is quite sick. If anybody saw... Daily Show today. It was kind of funny.
Who is your pick for the 2012 GOP presidential nomination?
Yeah, now this is by U.S. News Politics, okay? But the thing that drives you out of your mind is this. Okay. The field of GOP candidates for 2012 primaries is still nebulous. John Thune this week announced his decision against running, but a host of other potential candidates have hemmed and hawed. U.S. News blogger Robert. You know what's interesting? Hang on a second. Okay. This one was no. Okay, let's forget this. Okay.
They have a list of candidates, but the only one they don't
have on there is
Ron Paul.
Right, but this one here, this was also posted February 24th. All right, so that was before a lot of them ran, but
yeah.
It's no different than. Then what happened is that
it was a straw poll.
Yeah, the media has
they only
totally.
Well, they only report pieces. They never report the whole thing. Like Fox News doesn't ever report anything completely.
But they totally ignored the guy who came in second, which was Ron Paul.
Yeah,
you know, and this is like totally freaking unbelievable.
Well, they don't want them.
The other thing that's kind of interesting to me, let's go to this one. How the political right bullied the U.S. government into ignoring the threat of right-wing extremism. And this tells a lot about what's going on and how the conservatives have just overwhelmed the government.
Well, they own the media.
They own the media.
Now, go down to the end of that page. Now, keep going to the end, and it says... It'll say, put it all on one page. It was a single page right there.
This is kind of a long article, but I'm only going to go through a couple of pages of it.
And hopefully we can get it all. Okay.
After right-wingers freaked out about a report detailing the rise of right-wing extremism, Homeland Security effectively dismantled a unit tasked with tracking it. In the wake of the terrorist attack in Norway by right-wing extremist
Breivik,
conservative media pundits rushed to vilify anyone who brought up the underlying far-right ideology that fueled Breivik's violence. The uproar that follows any suggestion that right-wing extremism is on the rise works to silence the conversation about the danger of right-wing militancy. According to disturbing revelations by a former Homeland Security intelligence analyst, the consequences of this dynamic extend to the highest branches of U.S. government. For 6 years, Daryl Johnson headed the Department of Homeland Security team tracking domestic extremist groups. Now, Johnson, who is no longer with the DHS, says that conservative furor over the reports findings pressured Homeland Security to abandon reporting on and monitoring the rising threat of right-wing extremism in the past 2 years. You want to finish that?
Yeah. In April 2012, April 2009, DHS issued an intelligence assessment co-authored by Johnson titled "Right-Wing Extremism: Current Economic and Political Climate Fueling Resurgence in Radicalization and Recruitment." The document was one of many threat assessments shared between DHS, state and local law enforcement agencies, to keep them apprised of potential and looming threats and warned of a surge in right-wing extremism due to the election of the country's first black president and the economic recession. Although the report was intended only for distribution to law enforcement agencies, it was immediately leaked to the media, causing political firestorm among conservative pundits, who wrongly suggested that it labeled all conservatives as potential terrorists. DHS initially defended the report, but within days caved to the political pressure and practically disowned it. It was Secretary Napolitano apologizing to the American Legion for the report's mention of military veterans. But DHS did more than just publicly buckle under the political weight of conservative critics. According to Johnson, the department effectively dismantled his intelligence team following the rights uproar. In an in-depth interview published in the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report, Johnson reveals the level of sway the political right had in thwarting intelligence work on right-wing extremism. He says DHS deliberately mischaracterized the report as unauthorized, even though it had passed through the proper channels and instituted restrictive policies that brought the important work of his unit to a virtual standstill. As a result, Johnson left DHS in dismay and was followed by almost all members of his team, leaving a single analyst where there had been six. In comparison, there are at least 25 analysts devoted to tracking Islamic terrorism. When questioned about Johnson's claims, which have been confirmed by current and former department officials in the Washington Post, DHS officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, have repeatedly disputed his account and insists that the level of activity by right-wing extremist groups has remained consistent over the past few years. In addition, they claim the perception of increased extremist activity may be due to increased awareness of the threat by the government and the public, but the numbers beg to differ. Right-wing extremism on the rise.
Johnson's report was consistent with data from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which finds that hate groups topped 1,000 for the first time since Southern Poverty Law Center began counting such groups in the 1980s. The most dramatic growth was seen in anti-government patriot groups, militias, and other extremist organizations that see the federal government as their enemy, which came roaring back to life over the past year after more than a decade out of the limelight. Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence project identified 824 anti-government patriot groups that were active in 2010, up just 149 in 2008. And according to Mark Potok, director of Southern Poverty Law Center Intelligence Project, these groups are driven by resentment over changing racial demographics, which he describes as the idea that the country is becoming less white every day, and in fact the predictions of the Census Bureau that whites will lose their majority over the next about the year 2050 in the United States is very important. Virtually every white supremacist in America knows that date, and other drivers, including frustration over the economy and the mainstreaming of conspiracy theories and propaganda aimed at various minorities. Potok told Alternet that events following the 2009 Department of Homeland Security report had proved it to be prescient. In May 2009, just 1 month after the report released, an anti-abortion zealot murdered Dr. George Tiller in Kansas. In June 2009, neo-Nazi James von Braun murdered a security guard at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. In March 2010, nine members of a Michigan militia were charged with seditious conspiracy and attempted use of weapons of mass destruction in connection with an alleged plot to murder police officers. And on May 20th, 2010, two West Memphis, Arkansas police officers were shot to death during a routine traffic stop by a father-son duo of sovereign citizens, a group of U.S. residents who believe the government has no authority over them. And West Memphis Police Chief Bob Poder, whose son was one of the officers killed, told me that prior to the loss of his son, he had never heard of sovereign citizens, nor had any other law enforcement official he spoke to about the matter. After some digging and research, he discovered that his son's murder was not an isolated incident, and in fact, sovereign citizens were responsible for dozens of police officer deaths around the country.
Poder was particularly surprised to learn that the sovereign movement is estimated at 300,000 people strong and growing, which is why he was disappointed in the federal government's failure to alert state and local enforcement that such a threat existed. Poder says he is absolutely positive that they had been alerted and trained to recognize sovereign citizens, my son would still be alive today. The loudest outcry came from the right-wing shock jocks like Rush Limbaugh, who claimed that Janet Napolitano and Barack Obama were portraying standard, ordinary, everyday conservatives as posing a bigger threat to this country than al-Qaeda terrorists or genuine enemies of the country like Kim Jong-il. Sean Hannity warned his Fox News viewers that if you have a pro-life or bumper sticker on your car, if you have an America is an overtaxed bumper sticker, if you have a pro-Second Amendment bumper sticker, they're viewing you potentially as a radical.
This is true, though, because we read this on our programs before, and I read that when that came out, we read that that entire thing that they sent to the they actually sent this thing to the law enforcement agencies. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
And we read it, and what they were saying, that if you have bumper stickers or if you
t-shirts.
Have T-shirts or anything that's, that's pro-American or, you know, whatever, you're a potential terrorist, patriot terrorist or whatever.
Like a patriot.
Yeah.
One of those bunch
of groups. Right. And so, possibly, the most deranged interpretation, conservative blogger Michelle Malkin wrote that the report was a hit job on conservatives and one of the most embarrassing, shoddy pieces of propaganda I'd ever read out of DHS. I couldn't believe it was real. The real piece of crap report issued on April 7th is a sweeping indictment of conservatives, she wrote. And in a sad sort of irony, Johnson told SPLC that the conservative media personalities who misinterpreted and attacked his report would have been shocked to know that I personify conservatism. I'm an Eagle Scout. I'm a registered Republican. I'm a Mormon. In fact, I was helping the Boy Scouts with a fundraiser when I heard the report being attacked on the news. Outrage over the report's finding quickly spread to Congress, where several conservative lawmakers demanded the ouster of DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano. And among them was Representative John Carter, a Republican of Texas, who remarked, "We shouldn't even give her the respect of letting her resign. She should be fired by the administration for accusing honest American citizens because of their political beliefs of being domestic terrorists." And they did, but the conservatives yelled like hell about liberals.
Yeah.
Right? When liberals wore T-shirts or did everything, they kicked them out of malls, and anti-war anything, okay? And we were all hit. But, a conservative? No. These guys can kill cops and do whatever they want. But, you can't watch them. And a self-described conservative and Christian nonprofit, Thomas More Law Center, went even further and filed a lawsuit against Secretary Napolitano on behalf of a Michigan-based anti-abortion group, claiming the DHS report was all part of a conspiracy between the Obama administration and liberal groups to violate their constitutional rights. And a section of the report had stirred the most controversy, referred to disgruntled military veterans. I remember reading this.
Mm-hmm.
And cautioned that right-wing extremists would attempt to recruit and radicalize returning veterans to boost their violent capabilities.
This did not sit well with David Rieben, the commander of the veterans organization American Legion, who wrote in a letter to Secretary Napolitano, "To continue to use McVi as an example of the stereotypical disgruntled military veterans is as unfair as using Osama bin Laden as the sole example of Islam. Had Ruben Raven actually read the full report, he would have discovered that this specific concern was based on factual data collected by the FBI. The DHS assessment cited in July 2008 report by the FBI's Counterterrorism Division under the Bush administration titled White Supremacist Recruitment of Military Personnel Since 9/11. Based on its findings, the 2008 FBI report observed that some returning military veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have joined extremist groups and that military experience is found throughout the white supremacist extremist movement as a result of recruitment campaigns by extremist groups and self-recruitment by veterans sympathetic to white supremacist causes. Furthermore, based on analysis of FBI case files from October 2001 to May 2008, the report identified 203 military personnel or veterans who were active members in white supremacist organizations during that period. It is not surprising that the conservatives threw a fit. What's disturbing is that these conservatives' complaints prompted DHS to withdraw the report.
Pretending the threat doesn't exist. I spoke with Johnson, who had been following right-wing extremism in a professional capacity since the early 90s. And upon the Democratic nomination of President or then Senator Obama, Johnson says that based on his experience and expertise, he immediately recognized that this would be a huge recruiting tool for groups like white supremacists, militia extremists, sovereign citizen extremists, whose extremist groups that are on the fringe of the right of the political spectrum, which we refer to as right-wing extremists in the counterterrorism community. When it was clear that Barack Obama would win, Johnson became worried about the political radicalism factor that would ensue following the election of America's first black president. It would agitate people to go beyond their mainstream and law-abiding protest activity to more criminal activity and violence because people would see that these enemies, so to speak, these minorities in America are actually integrated in society, and they're actually fulfilling the American dream. And all of this prompted the drafting of the report in the early months of Obama's administration.
This is a very long one.
Yeah, no, no. I think I'm going to ask people to go to it. It goes along. It actually finishes there. But I hope that people will go to it. It's on alternet.org, and it's called How the Political Right Bullied the Department of Homeland Security.
So you can see how it was done. It was done by the media and various conservatives who targeted that, and they just made it impossible so that we're not protected from that anymore.
In keeping with our tradition of trying to give you some health news, this one here, the major drug research company faked thousands of documents to get drugs approved. FDA says it was no big deal. Imagine that. Oh, no. Okay, hang on a second.
This is from Natural News?
Yep. Want to help me read that? Or?
I think we can read part of it. It's pretty long.
It's only about 3 pages.
Natural News. It is truly astounding to witness the utter corruption that takes place and practically in plain sight within the pharmaceutical drug industry. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has announced that the drug firm Cetero Research, for many years, knowingly forged thousands of clinical trial documents for drug companies in order for them to gain drug approval. The FDA's response to this, though, is that the massive corruption is basically no big deal. It is no secret, of course, that the FDA routinely works in illicit tandem with drug companies to get dangerous drugs on the market in exchange for cash. One example of this includes the Lexapro scandal, in which the FDA approved this dangerous antidepressant drug for children at the same time as federal and state governments were suing Forest Laboratory makers of the drug for pushing it on children. The FDA's own scientists have even publicly indicted the agency for censoring truthful scientific data, intimidating and unfairly targeting supplement companies, and using the drug approval system to extort cash from drug companies in exchange for its rubber stamp of approval. The entire racket between the FDA and Big Pharma is mind-bogglingly extensive, and it's even seen in the FDA's recent announcement against Cetero. While it initially appears that the FDA is upset at Cetero for lying via its clinical trials document, The agency solution is to tell the drone companies to go back and redo them themselves.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
The FDA did not regulate in truly regulating drug industry. Tells it to go regulate itself. In the FDA's recent announcement concerning Zotero, the agency declared that both an internal company's investigation and a third-party audit revealed significant instances of misconduct and violations in conducting clinical trials. Between April 2005 and June 2009, there were at least 1,900 instances of fraud and falsified studies. And each one of these instances was falsely used to prove that a drug was safe before it went on the market.
Mm-hmm.
The pattern of misconduct was serious enough to raise concerns about the integrity of the data Sutro generated during the five-year time frame. I would think so. And this is a quote from the FDA. It said the FDA, noting that drugs companies may have to go back and perform new safety studies. But the real kicker is that the FDA also stated that this is not really that big of a deal. Millions of people's lives are on the line as potential fatal drugs were approved in false data. But according to the FDA, nobody should be concerned. In fact, the FDA has known for years that Celtro had been falsifying data, and the agency has done absolutely nothing about it.
One would assume that the nation's Food and Drug Regulatory Agency would at least have saved records of which drug companies use Zotero for their early clinical trials. Such information is standard on any drug application, right? Apparently not. The FDA actually has no idea which companies use Zotero's services and is now asking companies to search their records and determine whether or not they contracted with Zotero. Even a cursory analysis of this whole approach shows how utterly foolish it actually is. Does the FDA really think that drug companies that use Zotero are going to willingly participate in this?
Of course not.
Of course not. It would mean that the companies would have to go back and redo their clinical trials if they fess up. These are important questions that should be asked. Why does the FDA itself not have the records of research companies used for the drugs that it approves? Why is the FDA apparently unconcerned about the safety of these drugs, considering they were approved using falsified data? Why is the FDA not attempting to hold Zotero accountable for its actions, other than to make an announcement about them? Despite the nonchalant way in which the mainstream media is reporting on the issue, what Zotero has done is nothing short of high-profile crime. By falsifying drug trial data, Zotero has willingly put millions of people's lives at risk. The only right thing to do is immediately shut down the company and order a full investigation. All parties involved must be held accountable, including those at the FDA that may have been complicit as well. However, in the real world, the FDA solution is to tell the fox to go back and guard the hen house a little bit better, while simultaneously reassuring the world that the fox itself is safe and would never hurt anybody. In fact, the agency is actually alleging that all approved drugs, even those that were approved with falsified Zotero data, are perfectly safe and unlikely to be affected by the massive criminal cover-up.
So there you have it. Well, it's absolutely insane to make such a claim. The FDA has done just that, and it expects the world to take it seriously. The FDA's logic is essentially no different than, say, an amusement park claiming that all of its roller coasters are safe, even after it was determined by multiple investigations that the manufacturer of the coasters had lied about the quality of the materials used and that the pieces may not actually hold together. The question remains, would you ride those roller coasters or have the nerve to tell other people to ride those roller coasters? The FDA did. And that's the way it is, folks. I mean, it's just a sick, stupid, unbelievably incredible.
We have about 4 minutes left, Leo.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. That's our regulatory agency, you know? Unbelievable, no? Let's go back here. Oh, this is a good one to end with. Let's see. Why George Soros is selling gold and buying farmland?
Well, it makes sense because food has gotten astronomically expensive.
Yeah.
And it's going to be more and more expensive, and he's going to have control of it all.
Well, maybe that's why we... Do you want to read this one, or maybe you answered the question already?
Oh, that's what I think.
Why growing and storing your own food can be a gold mine.
Let's read that.
All this means we can count on three things happening in years ahead. Prediction number: food supplies will become more scarce. Food prices will double over the next 2 to 3 years, and then probably double again in another 2 to 3 years. Prediction three: when food prices are 400% of today's levels, backyard farming or gardening pays off big in terms of real dollar savings. In other words, as food prices skyrocket, it becomes increasingly more financially viable to grow your own food or store it now while prices are low. I'm listing some resources below where you can learn more about growing your own food or storing high-density superfoods right now. But in the meantime, I'd like you to start considering the idea of starting your own garden in the spring. Lessons from post-World War II Taiwan and why food is more valuable than gold. I lived in Taiwan for 2 years, and I've had the opportunity to talk with people who were living through the post-World War II recovery. And during the war, of course, Taiwan was occupied by the imperialist Japanese Empire, and Taiwan existed in a state of military occupation and martial law. After the war ended, and the Japanese left, Taiwan bootstrapped its own government into power under
Chiang Kai-shek.
Right, and the old Taiwan currency was immediately printed in large quantities by the Taiwan government, leading to a runaway inflation scenario, so that it now called the old Taiwan dollar very quickly. However, the government launched a new currency called the new Taiwan dollar. By 1949, the old Taiwan dollar was being exchanged for new Taiwan dollars at a ratio of 4,000 to 1.
During those years after World War II, if you wanted to rent an apartment, buy a house, or find a place to live, cash was worthless, and even gold wasn't considered very useful. The only thing that represented real wealth was food. If you had food, you could trade it for anything, an automobile, a home, tools, clothing, or even land. If you don't have food, you were bankrupt, regardless of how much cash or gold you had. A chicken that could lay an egg was worth more than an ounce of gold. You can't eat gold, folks. You can't eat silver. Everybody has to eat to stay alive, and that means everybody needs a constant stream of food to just keep breathing. That's why investing in food makes so much sense. And by investing in food, I mean any of the following: investing in storable food that you could save on the shelf and keep for the future, or barter. Investing in your own gardening skills so you have know-how to produce food when needed. Investing in non-hybrid seeds so that you have the genetic blueprint to grow food that can propagate itself. Investing in farmland, especially farmland with water that offers the fertility and climate to produce food. Investing in educational courses that teach you how to create food through a variety of methods. Wildcrafting, gardening, sprouting, and so on. Oh.
So that's it, folks. That's how you know. So invest in food
and
gardening.
We certainly want to thank you for being with us tonight.
Yes.
And we thank our guests. We thank Woody, and we thank Fred Claridge.
Yes.
Who talked to us about Social Security and Medicare. It's there, but we need to take care of it to make sure it stays there. And
fight like hell to keep it.
That's right.
That's what we hope to do. So I want to thank everybody again, and I wish you a pleasant evening. And join us again tomorrow night right here at 8 o'clock.
Yeah. See you then.
All right, folks. Good night.
Good night.